The fact that the media is giving this guy airtime when right now there are hundreds of thousands of people, including children, in concentration camps, I have absolutely just utter contempt for the fact that this is getting any airplay.
Now, in the book, you have him talking.
But the book is terribly funny.
I'm John Tierney. Welcome to the Museum of Sex. I am here for a discussion of a very unusual book. It's an unauthorized autobiography. It's called Dear Reader. It's the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. And with me is Dear Writer, Michael Malice. Now, Michael, he brings an interesting background to this. He was born in Ukraine under communist rule, came at a very early age to Brooklyn. And he has been a ghostwriter for autobiographies of Bret Michaels, the rock star, the ultimate fighting champ Matt Hughes, the comedian D.L. Hughesley. He co-wrote Concierge Confidential. So it must have been different, I imagine, working with Kim Jong-il, the Dear Leader. And I wonder if you could just start by telling us how you got the idea for this book and how you worked with the great man.
Well, as Kim Jong-il says, it takes a great man to understand a great man. That's a quote from the book. No, I was working on another project, and it wasn't going so hot, and my friend took me out of the house and in Arizona, and he said, hey, you should write Kim Jong-il's autobiography. And I thought, this is just a brilliant idea because he's probably the most famous person out there that would never write his own autobiography, at least not for American audiences. And everyone has an awareness of him, but few people have a knowledge and information about him. So usually when I write an autobiography, you work with the person, you interview them, they write, you know, you work together. Obviously, Kim Jong-il was not available to me because I'm not Korean and he's deceased. So these are two big hurdles I had to overcome. But of course, being magic, it was easy to do. So I actually went to North Korea and I got stacks and stacks of the propaganda. And I read the entire Western canon as well about North Korea. So I read 60 books, and I used that to adapt it to a first-person narrative of his life. And it mapped out perfectly to a history of North Korea because he was born in World War II as North Korea was becoming a country. He died in 2011. So he's like their Forrest Gump. Whenever anything of interest happens in North Korea, Kim Jong-il's there. They claim that even as a child of age 3, he was sitting at his father Kim Il-sung's knee and advising him against the wicked Japs. So he's really at every point in time. So when you read this book and you learn his life story, you're actually learning a life history of North Korea and how it got to be the way it is.
Now, how much of the prose in the book is of the sentences are actually things he said about, you know, for instance, he compared one of his theories of literature, I believe, it was equivalent to Columbus discovering America.
Yes.
So, and another one of his was compared to the discovery of fire, I believe.
Right, right. So it's very, there's all these superlatives that they use in the propaganda, which of course every single one of them I cut and pasted because they were just amazing. They compared his college thesis, which was the role of the county in building socialism, hardly groundbreaking work even by their standards, to, that was, I think, comparable to Columbus discovering America. And the Copernican Revolution is compared to, I think, his theory of art. So every time they use some profound sense of phrase, of praise, I absolutely use their own language. In fact, one of the books, one of the biographies of him called The People's Leader, they talk about as he grew up, he learned many qualities from the communist guerrillas, including manliness, magnanimity, intelligence, hardworking, and modesty. And but they ended on modesty. And I'm like, are they taunting us? So that's in there. I have that as a little sidebar of the qualities he learned at his father's knee.
Now, did he, did you have much stuff in his words, his speeches, or what did you have to work with?
Yeah, one of the things people ask me often is, how do you know what he really thought? And the idea that anyone in North Korea could have any doubt what Kim Jong-il thought about anything is absolutely as absurd as some of the stories, because he wrote about gymnastics, magic tricks, dance, architecture, the cinema, literature, war, politics, history, cooking, Apparently Koreans lack an enzyme, and that's why they have to eat kimchi.
That was some of his scientific work, I guess.
Maybe. Well, he also discovered that Paleolithic man originated on the Korean Peninsula. Yeah. And in fact, when he told the North Korean archaeologists where to look, that's exactly where they found the remains. What a genius. And Korean was one of the first languages spoken by man, and Korea was the first government on Earth.
Of course. Now, how much of this stuff, did you have any sense for how much of this he really believed?
People
in North Korea believed also because you were there.
We do have a great sense of what he really believed for several reasons. As we saw recently with Kim Jong-un killing his uncle, a lot of high-level people have defected over the years, including the man who invented the term Juche, which is the leading philosophy of North Korea. So many members of his inner circle have fled, because for fear for their lives. And even being wealthy, in North Korea, when you have a gun to your head, it's like the Sword of Damocles kind of situation. So we really have a good understanding of how he thought. We also, there were several instances where people had hidden tape recorders and they spoke to him. And it's just fascinating to hear his concerns, when he thinks the cameras are off. Well, he's only spoken one sentence in public ever, which is glory to the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. That's the only thing he's ever said in public, just one sentence. So now everyone here is a world authority on his public speeches. But what's terrifying, and his son, of course, defected, but what's terrifying is, during the famine in the 90s, which, devastated the economy and the country, he's concerned that the Korean breed of dog is being driven to extinction. So his priorities were very, very clear, Korea, but not the Korean people themselves. And he put that plan into practice with bloody consequences.
Right. Now, in the book, you have him talking about that he was upset when he saw famine, that there was just grass, people weren't eating, right. But he then went home and went to work on it, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they claim that he wears those sunglasses because he's bloodshot from staying up all night trying to fix the country. And the famine, there's a big misconception people in America have about Kim Jong-il. This is the one thing I want everyone to understand. He is despised there. His father, Kim, it's like this. Let's suppose you met someone from another country, and they said they love American music, and they said they love Nancy Sinatra. She's their favorite artist. She's the best. They love her songs, love her style. And you say, great, what do you think of Frank Sinatra? And they say, who? And that is how Kim Jong-il is compared to his father, Kim Il-sung. Everything in the country is a function of his father, but most Americans only know the son. And in fact, when Kim Jong-il took over in 94 with his father, Kim Il-sung's death, that's when the famine hit. So he either got the blame for causing it, or at least not preventing it. So it's very easy to convince an isolated population that they're wealthy and that the world envies them. It's almost impossible to convince someone they have more food in their plate than they did last year, or that their children, aren't starving. So there's propaganda can only go so far, so he is really reviled. And he was aware of this. In fact, he cut his teeth on the Korean cinema, which is true. And when the people were cheering for him, he was caught saying, this isn't coming from the bottom of their hearts, this is all fake. So he knew that he was reviled in North Korea. And they called him the gruel lord, because people, by the end, they were hopeful to have gruel. They were eating, saccharin just to have something in their stomachs.
Now, growing up, it's very fun. I mean, the book is terrible to read about the mind.
Terrible?
No, it's hilarious.
What is this, NPR?
Yeah. No, you cut me off. It's terrible as far as the
stuff. Stop saying that!
But it's a hilarious read, is what I'm trying to get to here.
It's terrible.
Because he just, he'll be talking about that he came up with the idea in grade school, I think, was of self-criticism.
Oh, but yes.
That he realized this, and he said he did this, and he didn't realize how popular it would be,
So people don't understand what life is like under a totalitarian dictatorship. And one of the most telling things of what it's like is everyone in the country, every single person starting from grade school, once a week has to engage in a self-criticism session. You're funneled into a neighborhood group, your school, union, something. Everyone's in some group. It's called their organizational life. And once a week, you have to get up in front of all your peers and say, these are the mistakes I made this week. And then all your peers get up and denounce you in front of everybody else. And this happens weekly for everyone in the entire country. So we think totalitarianism is kind of like, you're forbidden to do certain things, or you're not allowed to leave your house. There is no element of North Korean life where the people's lives aren't regimented and under the thumb of the state. And you can imagine, you know, starting elementary school, you know, how you, in front of your whole school, like your friends have to be like, I saw you doing this. Everyone's watching everyone else.
And what kind of stuff will they confess, do you know?
Well, yeah, it's like I was late for work, or, you know, I wasn't paying attention to this paperwork as much as I should have. And the thing is, you have to have something to confess. So a lot of times, you know, when you get older, people have a friend and they say, I'll say you did this, you say I did that. Because if you're claiming to be perfect, well, no one's perfect but the great leader and the dear leader and now the marshal. So that's going to bring even worse consequences. And the other thing is, North Korean is a collectivist society, and punishment is collective. So when bad things happen to you, they happen to your whole family. So you really have a big gun to your head that you better, you know, follow suit, or else, you know, mom, dad, sister, cousins will suffer the consequences. And they boast about this, people, you know, constantly. I mean, American politicians, Rick Santorum, everyone's hero, often says the family is the basic unit of society. Well, what that means in practice is, if you commit a crime, your family should go to jail. That's what unit means, isn't it? Does he not speak English? It's my second language. I don't know. Maybe he should make it his first.
Did you get a sense from this, as far as it's the development of the country and of him, that, I mean, growing up, he was the son of the great leader.
Right.
I mean, he calls him marshal and general throughout. I didn't see any dads in there.
Father, yeah. No, yeah. In fact, they boast that his mom always referred to him as general and never as husband.
Yeah.
Because it's communist, so the person's role is more important than blood ties.
Right. So were people terrified of him his whole life then? I mean, it's very funny in school when they says, you know, the professor said, when he takes issue with a professor about something, the professor says, there's nothing with you that I can argue.
Yeah, of course.
You're so right.
So they claim he revolutionized all the universities while he was at university. It's just an amazing thing. They were not terrified of him growing up, because the idea that a son would succeed his father in a communist state is insane. It completely flies against all communist propaganda and philosophy. And in fact, there was a huge backlash in 1980 when Kim Il-sung named Kim Jong-il as his successor, because this was just a complete repudiation of Marxism and any kind of anti-hierarchical society. And it wasn't at all the case that it was clear that he would take over, as I go into in the book. Him and his uncle, kind of foreshadowing what happened recently, him and his uncle had a little war to see who would take over, and that's the big part of this personality cult around his father, Kim Il-sung, was a consequence of each of them trying to show how loyal they were to the dad who finally settled on the son, and culminating, of course, in that 6-story-high statue in Pyongyang of Kim Il-sung, which was originally plated in gold until, I believe it was Mao who said, you know, we're communist, maybe a gold icon in our capital city isn't what we're about, so now it's in bronze, which is much more, you know, tame. Yeah, and very populist.
Now, I wondered if you're thinking of a follow-up on this about his time management techniques, because he said in college, he said he read every classical book of philosophy and everything else. He mastered them all. He mastered every science, every art.
Right.
He also saw every movie that was out.
Sure. Chicken farming.
And he wrote, it's a great reading list. It's got like chicken farming and
gemstones.
And in addition to that, while he wrote 1,400 works, including these that were compared to Copernicus.
That 1,400 works, I included that because a lot of times people in the States or in the West get the propaganda wrong. He did write 1,400 works in college because they say works, including letters, essays, and books. So if that works out to one letter a day, everyone here has written 1,400 works over college. So it's a lot of times the propaganda, like for example, the uncle wasn't eaten by dogs. People are so used to thinking of North Korea as bonkers, and they are bonkers in a sense, but they're not bonkers in the sense that they're unpredictable. They very much have a clear, coherent philosophy, which most Western people do not have an understanding of, including people in the media, which is unfortunate. So part of what I had put forward in this book is, once you read it, you will understand why they do what they do, and it kind of reads like a murder mystery. We know who the victims are, the North Korean people. We know who the perpetrators are, and now you find out their motive and their means and how they, you know, took this proud country and just drove it into the ground, into the least free state on earth.
Would you want to give a real quick summary of how they did that? I mean, as far as the philosophy that led to that.
Well, I mean, it's 400 pages.
Right,
the quick summary. The quick summary.
This is television. Come on,
they.
I mean, how did that?
I'll give you one sentence.
I'll
give it to you one sentence. They practiced what they preached. Mm-hmm. They practiced what they preached when they said nothing beyond the state. that everyone lives as a function of their society, and when that philosophy is coherently and perfectly put into practice, and the leader is the embodiment of the people, and only the leader has true life, and your life is a function of defending the leader. Once those ideas are put into practice, this is what you see. You see a nation that has no electricity. You see a nation where children are 4 inches shorter than South Korea because of malnutrition. You see a complete, you know, Stalinist Orwellian nightmare with concentration camps. Because if there's no such thing as human rights, then the idea that you can be sent to, and your family can be sent to a camp makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, people talk about the importance of culture in developing a democracy or a free society. And Korea is such an interesting, because it's one country that gets divided, very similar culture, until suddenly this change happens. Do you have any thoughts about, how little does it take for something to go wrong for a culture to suddenly just degenerate?
Well, I think a lot of us in the West think that our allies are good guys and our enemies are bad guys. And usually our enemies are bad guys, but sometimes our allies are bad guys too. And South Korea was only a democracy until fairly recently, I mean, late 80s, early 90s. And in fact, in the early 80s, they had their own Tiananmen Square massacre where the U.S. was involved. And the U.S. doesn't deny that they happened. There was this big uprising and they came in with tanks and they started killing students. And, this is something that's kind of been swept under the rug. So a lot of the North Korean propaganda about the South was true. You know, after World War II, the U.S. installed this kind of Syngman Rhee straw man, and he was overthrown. But there was one kind of dictator after another, the culmination of which, when I read this in North Korean propaganda, I'm like, okay, this isn't true, but it's on Wikipedia. The head of the South Korean CIA assassinated the president and declared himself president, and he became the president. And it's just like, wait, what? And no, that really happened. The first lady was assassinated, you know? So there was all sorts of, you know, horrific things in the South that, you know, we've kind of forgotten, but they share a lot of commonalities. They're extremely xenophobic. There's a lot of, you know, Korean pride and contempt for any kind of, strong racialism and things like that. And so they're not as removed as we'd like them to be culturally. Mm-hmm. Politically, of course, it's night and day, and that's a, you know, good metaphor, because at night, you know, Seoul is lit up brightly, and if you look at the NASA map, at night, North Korea is just a black void.
Mm-hmm. But North Korea does have a better opera, thanks to Kim Jong-il, right?
Well, he revolutionized the opera. Opera used to be about, nobility and prostitutes. But now it's for the people. He invented something called pangchang, which is offstage singing, which that was also Copernicus, I think. They kept comparing him to Copernicus, so I kind of had to pick and choose the metaphor. Discovery of Fire, Copernicus, and Columbus were the big ones, yeah.
But how did the opera work?
So basically, you know, in Greek opera, you have the chorus, the choir on stage singing, right, to narrate the thoughts of the protagonist. North Korean opera is completely different because the choir's off stage. So it's nothing like the Greek one because they're off stage. It's an operatic revolution. And he actually did this. You know, they had this North Korean opera. They're very, very proud of it. You know, all the operas are about the leader or joining revolution or joining the party. But this was really their, you know, innovative form of art.
Yeah.
I've never seen one because I've read 60 books. I've had enough of their stuff. It's just like, please. I can read about it. I don't need to watch The Flower Girl, you know.
What was your sense when you were there? I was intrigued when you talked about the being in a place like that, which sounds so awful, that in some ways, and it reminded me when I was in Poland when it was a communist, and the thing that did surprise me, that Poland was fairly light communism by things, but it was that it seemed more normal. I lost my passport at one point. It was at the hotel, and I thought, oh my God, I'm behind the Iron Curtain without a passport. And nobody really cared. Right. The police didn't care. And you found some of that too, is that right, when you were there?
It's a mix of normalcy and you know, being in another planet back in time is how I called it. One of the things that really, really struck me, and this is kind of a telling anecdote, when I was born, as you said, in the Soviet Union. When I was a kid, my mom used to drag me to Century 21, which is this discount clothing store, literally every weekend. And I would spend hours there, and I'd go mad, you know, and I resented her enormously until I went to North Korea, because my guide, you know, is a young woman, and she's probably the equivalent of a millionaire by North Korean standards. She will never be able to buy a nice dress. She will never be able to buy makeup. She will never be able to buy perfume or hand lotion or lipstick, because there's none in the whole country. If we don't make it, we don't want it. So it kind of helped me understand that my mom, you know, growing up, she just wanted to look pretty, and this was not available to her. So of course it's going to give her, you know, kind of a bit of a complex. So what I want people to understand is the people in North Korea are desperately seeking a normal human, like, you know, Ayn Rand in the 50s spoke before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and she just commented, she goes, it's hard for a people in a free society to understand what it's like to live under a totalitarian dictatorship. She's like, and in a way, it's a good that you don't understand. Imagine what it's like to live in a nation where human life means nothing less than nothing, and you know it. And yes, you visit your mother-in-law, and you have a picnic and whatever, and you try to have some sense of normalcy, but there's absolutely no humanity whatsoever, and at night you're waiting for that, you know, doorbell to ring, or knock on the door, rather, and knowing that anyone can do anything to you at any time, and there's no repercussions for them. So they learn to do the dance, but they will never be free, and they know it. And they increasingly know it, and that's really what's scary. Mm-hmm.
Last question for me. Do you have any predictions for what's going to happen after reading? Is there any hope for North Korea in the near future, do you think?
In the near future, no, there's no hope. There's two points. There's two points I'll make. One is, if we look at the slaves post-Civil War, look how horrible it was for them for decades. So even if tomorrow the regime vanished, these people have never seen a computer. These people, you know, they have no understanding of history. It's very, very troubling. That's number one. Number two is, there was a quote, I think it was Steinbeck or Hemingway, and they said, how did you go bankrupt? And he replied, two ways, gradually and then suddenly. Mm-hmm. So when it happens, it's going to be like dominoes. Look at Romania. And in fact, North Korea is very aware of what happened in Romania, where Ceausescu was assassinated on TV, and they are making sure that's not going to happen to them, because in these nations, when the regime goes down, the leaders are personally murdered. You know, look at Libya, look at Iraq. So they have a very vested interest, even if they no longer believe in the Juche idea, in maintaining power and making sure nothing ever changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll open up for some questions now.
Has Kim Jong-il ever received a psychiatric evaluation?
Actually, what's really tragic is his first wife, who's the mother of his eldest son, she went mad. They sent her abroad they exiled her to Moscow for treatment. And also there's other, you know, he drove some people to madness by having them under surveillance 24/7, not allowed to leave their house. So he's even worse than people realize. But no, he's never had psychiatric evaluation.
I'm with you on
that. Oh, and one more thing. They're against Freudianism. That's part of the list of things they hate. Well, I mean, they're very chaste and ascetic, so any kind of sexuality is very forbidden there.
They would not be happy with you here at the Museum of Sex.
They don't care about me because I'm not Korean, so I'm a lost cause.
As someone with the Ayn Rand Institute, I'm particularly interested in your quotation or your familiarity with Ayn Rand, but more than
I own her copy of The Fountainhead.
Yeah.
I do.
But
I got it from you.
Particularly curious about how a kid from Brooklyn, and by kid, I mean a young fellow, got into this into the first place. I presume from the way you talk so intelligently on the subject that you speak the language. And
you mean English?
No, the other. said your second language, your first language.
My first language is Russian, yeah.
Yeah, well, do you, I understand it. You speak Korean, and did you translate all of this? How did you get into this?
That's a very good question. How did I get all these
really
books?
I really want to know the essence of,
sure,
aside from just a friend taking you out.
Sure.
How did all of this evolve? Ayn Rand first.
Ayn Rand obviously was a huge influence on me growing up, and us having a shared background. You know, Mises and I were born in the same town in Ukraine, Lvov, which is also the hometown of Masok, of masochism fame. I don't know what that says. It's true. Say it. So, but We the Living, this was my We the Living, because We the Living is from the perspective of maybe Kira, the protagonist, wasn't an average girl, but certainly a typical or regular person living under Stalinism. But here I have it from the other perspective. I have it from the perspective of the guy at the top and what he's implementing and his ideology and why he's doing. And there's something as an author kind of fun having someone reveling in censorship and public executions and all these other things, because again, they're not apologetic. they own it and they are proud of it and they boast about it. So this idea that this UN human rights report that came out, like, oh my God, this has been known for decades. And even Khrushchev was condemning them, for their wackiness. So Rand was We the Living was very much in mind. In fact, Rand had this great essay called The Monument Builders and about how these totalitarian dictatorships always build up these great monuments. So when I was there and being taken around to all these monuments, that's all I could think of. But the books are translated into several languages for a couple of reasons. One is the conceit is that everyone in the world is obsessed with the Juche idea and is interested in learning about it. But also because every one of these, self-absorbed little dictatorships, feels that they're important. And it's like, if people want to know about us, we have to give them that availability. We're not going to be the bottleneck that keeps them from learning about the Juche idea, which is the guiding light of the 21st century, as you know.
Why don't you explain what that is, briefly, the Juche idea.
The Juche idea is a word that means Smurf. Because you have Juche gymnastics and Juche architecture and Juche music and Juche opera, and what it amounts to in practice is that which Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung like. What they claim it means is that it's, first of all, they only this year started calling it the Juche philosophy instead of the Juche idea. I don't know where they made the switch. It was always the Juche idea. But the principle is that man is the master of everything and decides everything. Redundant, but that's how they phrase it. So basically that a man is at the highest of values, and everything in the world exists only to serve man, and you only live as part of a collective. So they have a very coherent and clever way of explaining it, which is a little bit like mirror image of Rand. It's like Lewis Carroll meets objectivism, which I go into in the book, which is really kind of fun and fascinating because the deduction just goes in complete opposite directions.
But how does that relate to the idea that everything has to be Korean? And he talks about the argument when a professor, an economics teacher, gave a lecture and dared to point out that it's better to buy from someone who's good at selling apples rather than trying to do everything yourself, basically right. Comparative advantage. Right. And he stands up and denounces him and that this can't be right.
Well, one of the big denunciation is like the students were learning Russian and they're walking around Pyongyang saying the capital of Russia is Moscow, and they're saying this in Russian. He goes, no, you should say the capital of Korea is Pyongyang. The example should be Korean. So everything so they're ultra, 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 ultra nationalist, right? So they're much closer to fascism than they are to communism in most senses. So I asked a refugee, I go, if this is a philosophy by Koreans for Koreans, why, according to you, would anyone else in the world care? And they never gave that answer. But you're not going to be questioning it when you're told this, when your whole family's at gunpoint. So that's really a big gaping hole in a kind of a big net of gaping holes of their worldview.
And there's no Mona Lisa.
He hates the Mona Lisa. I asked my mom, I said, why does Kim Jong-il hate the Mona Lisa? And she paused, no doubt remembering her upbringing. She goes, because it's ambiguous. And that's right. Art has to have a clear message for all the people. And therefore, it's good art. That's the criterion for good art.
How's his golf game? And how's that reconciled with the amount of golf courses in North Korea?
I believe there's only one golf course in North Korea. The funny thing about Kim Jong-il is, like, a lot of people focus on the supernaturalism. It's more the superhuman aspect, that he's really good at everything. And that also serves a purpose. You see all these pictures in newspapers of him visiting factories. That is supposed to tell the people things are bad, but he's on the case. So he's good at everything, and it'll be okay. Daddy's here.
I wanted to ask you, I don't know how much time you really spent in North Korea.
5 days.
Okay, so it's not so much. How do you think people actually change under such a regime, and how do they maintain their humanity? What happens to them?
There's lots of parallels. If you look at the Jewish Holocaust, you look at slavery, how people try to maintain some kind of semblance of humanity. It's through things. They have great senses of humor, which is something that never even entered my head. They gossip with their friends. You have family bonds that are close. And it's, again, if you have these criticism sessions, you're encouraged to be a gossip, right? Because you're supposed to be like, oh, did you see what she did? So that is a big kind of semblance. But again, it's the hardest place to maintain your humanity on Earth, especially if during the famine. I can't even wrap my head around it, thank God.
Any North Korean jokes you want to share?
Sure. I asked my guide, I said, tell me a North Korean joke. And she goes, okay. Mommy goes, hey, I don't want to go to school today, and I give you two good reasons. One, all the kids hate me, and two, all the teachers hate me. And the mom goes, son, you have to go to school today. I'll give you two good reasons. One, you're the principal, and two, you're 35 years old. It's funny. And the fact that she had one off the cuff, you know, it just really, and any joke you tell them just about the Japanese, ooh, they love that. Yes. So
Jap bastards.
Kim Jong-il explicitly said whenever you refer to a foreigner from a country that they hate, which is Japan or America, you don't say American, you say Yank Devil or Jap Bastard. And in fact, they don't teach them that in World War II, the U.S. and Japan were antagonists, because that's kind of hard to explain. Us in Japan have always been conspiring to kind of seize Korea.
I have two questions. One, my mother went to North Korea with the Asia Society, and she said one of the most bizarre things they did was go to this incredible amusement park, which she said was one of the most amazing amusement parks she'd ever been to in her life. And they seemed to let them speak to the teenagers and 20-somethings that were there. I had assumed to her that they were plants, but she's claims that they managed to have some side conversations, and I wondered what the hell that was about, given this. Is that all for a Western show?
There's no way that those weren't plants, because you're not allowed to talk to foreigners unless you're really high up. There's a hierarchy there. You have it's like a kind of like a credit rating. They have a caste system. So for someone to be trusted to talk to foreigners, you really have to be very, very trusted. So just any kids is just absolutely impossible.
So what's that amusement park for?
Well, the amusement parks are for the people, but the people who were there, they knew they were coming, that the Westerners were coming, so of course they were there to have people talk to them. I'm sure their conversations were sincere, but I'm sure these people were pre-screened and told, you know, what to talk about, what not to talk about.
And secondly, within all of this insanity, can you explain our basketball friend?
Dennis Rodman should have a bullet put in him. Anyone who goes on TV and when asked about what about concentration camps says, we have prisons, what's the difference? Which is in the guise of a rhetorical question, but actually is a question that would have an 8-hour answer. Anyone who goes on TV, and I'm not a fan of this president, and who tells the president Kim Jong-un is waiting for your call, and challenges the president on behalf of a foreign nation, anyone who humanizes a regime where the leader kills his own family and the family of his family, I don't care how drunk, crazy, or stupid you are a monster. This kind of Lillian Hellman, you know, nonsense. So the fact that the media is giving this guy airtime when right now there are hundreds of thousands of people, including children, in concentration camps where men are being sent to mines where their skin will fall off because they will never see sunlight again and have vitamin D deficiency. I have absolutely, I just utter contempt for the fact that this is getting any airplay.
Now, in the book, you have him talking.
But the book is terribly funny. It's a gift. It's a gift. It is, though.
Right. Well, it does have great touches, like when he's talking about the airplane flight that was there, and he said that there was a Korean agent accused of it, and he said, and that was ridiculous, of course, because if I use someone, I go abduct Japanese women. Right. Why don't you tell us about that?
So there's this is a great, great story. And this the craziest stuff I left in, and I didn't change it because it's so crazy that people don't believe it. Then they go on Wikipedia, they're like, oh, everything of this is true. In 1988, Seoul was granted the 1988 Olympics. And Kim Jong-il said, hey, wouldn't it be great if North Korea and South Korea co-hosted? And South Korea goes, okay. The Olympics aren't granted to a country, they're granted to a city, which is Seoul, so that doesn't make sense. And it's not for us to share it with you. And he's like, come on. And they're like, that doesn't make any sense. You don't even have any facilities. And he's like, come on. And they're like, no. And he's like, okay. So he sent an agent to put a bomb on one of their airliners. The bomb went, and she got off, her and a man. They got off. They were apprehended. They start smoking cyanide-laden cigarettes. He died. She did not. She was captured, taken to South Korea. Everyone died. She went on TV. She announced what she had done, mea culpa. She was pardoned by the South Korean president because she was brainwashed by Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. Let me repeat that. A woman went on TV, admitted to blowing up a plane and killing everyone on board, and she received a pardon. Not a commutation. She's walking around now, South Korea, happy as can be. It would really be like Clinton, you know, pardoning Timothy McVeigh. So South Korea is a pretty wacky place. And that's, you know, her whole story. She had a book deal here, you know, so I don't know. It's pretty nuts.
But then what did, then how did he respond when he was accused of sending the agent?
Oh, right. So the point is, Kim Jong-il is not perfect because he has publicly apologized once, which is for the following. For years, Japanese citizens were vanishing, you know, from beaches, from shopping malls, and people thought this was North Korea abducting them. But they were like random, you know, there's nothing in common. And of course, a lot of people in the left, in academia, no doubt, said, you guys are ready to believe everything about North Korea. Come on, they're not that crazy. Well, during the famine, the Japanese in 2001, the Japanese prime minister came to North Korea, and Kim Jong-il said, yeah, about all those abductions, my bad. It was one of my people, but they've been punished. It'll never happen again. So will you give us more rice now, please? And he's like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, no, this really happened. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Can we have reparations for World War II? And they're like, no. And the Japanese had so much food that they didn't have storage space, and they literally threw it in the ocean rather than send it to North Korea after these confessions. And Kim Jong-il was like, I don't get it. I apologized. It's like, and that is all true.
And so why was he abducting them again, though?
He was abducting them to train them to be spies, to teach them Japanese, teach them Japanese mores. And in fact, the woman who bombed the plane, when she was caught by the South Korean CIA, and she was claiming, insisting she was Japanese, they're like, okay, what street did you grow up on? What was your favorite TV show? What was your favorite candy? And she's like, Kim Jong-il Street, the Kim Jong-il show. I mean, she's had no exposure to the rest of the world. How is she going to be able to guess any of these things? Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that people were shocked or surprised that the son was selected as a successor. What might they have expected instead?
Well, I mean, if you look at every other communist country, they have, you know, someone who's the head of, you know, the army or the head of the Korean People's, the Workers' Party of Korea, which is their, you know, their political party. So, you know, the idea that the son, who wasn't a military figure either, would be taking over this militaristic nation was just completely just whacked. Let's get the mic to Andrews.
Do you want to talk more about why they did make that decision? I mean, you mentioned about it having to do with loyalty, but it's still interesting. Like, what was it? I don't know. Or do we have to read the book?
Well, no, I mean, definitely read the book. Because this is one of the great things that I learned while writing this book is that all the criticism that is leveled at them, they don't sweep it under the rug. They look at it, they put it out. So when I wrote this book, you get the Western perspective and you get the Northern response. So they look at it, they spell out the Western analysis, and they go, this is why it's wrong. So he owns the fact that this was weird that he was the successor, but he puts it forward as, look at Khrushchev, look at all these other countries. When you look at, you know, Bush after Reagan, what's the guy's name after Thatcher, John Major. When you don't have a good successor, the revolution goes to pot. And you know that I'm just like my dad. So it makes sense that we're going to continue through the generations. And in fact, in 94, when Kim Jong-il took over, people think this is a joke when I add it in the book, and it's not. His campaign slogan was, do not expect any change from me. That's what the billboards all said.
More of the same.
More of the same. He's the... It worked. 100% of the vote. Yeah.
But he says in your book now that he does not have concentration camps, though. Right.
Right. They don't call them... What North Korea, again, was recently attacked for concentration camps, and their answer is, and this is... I can't make this up. We don't use the term political prisoner camps in North Korea, and therefore we don't have them. So there, that takes care of that.
Did you get any sense of the possibility of an underground or a subversion in any sense, or is it impossible?
There's no underground whatsoever, but there is subversion in this sense. When you don't have food, you can't pay your thugs. So you have the border guards between the river between North Korea and China, and that's gotten very, very porous because people go over, they sell ginseng in China and or whatever they do, then they bring food back, and those guards who are there, they get their cut. So, and that's how a lot of information is getting into the DPRK. So that's the subversion is they're not believing, they had to change the propaganda. The propaganda used to be, you know, we're the happiest place on earth. But now the propaganda is, we're the only ones maintaining Koreanness, and we're building like a better future. We're poor, but we're united. So that is a very important shift. And it used to be that they fed everybody, and now it's kind of like find your own food, so they no longer boast about like we're taking care of you. So these are big changes that they've had to kind of deal with.
Why did they, what happened? For a while they were actually doing better economically than South Korea, but then what brought on the famine?
Sure, they were, you know, South Korea was an agrarian backwater for many, many years. And North Korea had huge, because they played China versus Russia and they were basically a welfare state. And they got a lot of money and they're doing well for themselves. And the other sense is, when you level an entire country like we did to them during the Korean War, the Fatherland Liberation War, as they call it, it's very easy to get economic growth when you're starting with zero. I mean, it's like 100% economic growth. Now I have a rock, you know? Yeah. So the statistics are skewed in that sense. But the famine hit because with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the welfare payments that stopped going to them, and the fact that they were the only communist nation to default on their loans, everyone started to demand getting payment in, you know, hard currency, which they did not have. So they lost gasoline shipments. And once you lose gasoline, you lose electricity. And once you lose electricity, you're done because they had to have, they're very mountainous regions, so they have to have a lot of fertilizer. So they can't build food. They can't have cars. They converted many of their cars to wood burning, which is not a very effective method to move a vehicle. So. But I mean, it's funny, we laugh, but I mean, this is the only thing that wood burning got some people fed. So I mean, it's just really awful. Yes.
It's easy for us to see the flaws since we're outsiders for North Korea, but has writing this book given you any insight into things about the US that we might not be aware of?
Oh. Oh boy. There is no much, there. Okay, I'm on camera. His critiques of U.S. foreign policy are really spot on and fun. Because when we all laugh at Kim Il-sung and the stories about him, and I have Kim Jong-il point out, well, in America, they are of the belief that the greatest minds in history all just happened to be localized on the East Coast in the 18th century of America. And that the Constitution is magic. And also his attack on this kind of American heavy-handedness that we can just go in any other nation and topple their regime and just leave it a complete ruin. So those were some valid points. But also this, you know, the propaganda of, like, you know, obviously Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung are beatified, basically, in North Korea, but we have our own secular saints here, Anne Frank, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Lincoln. You know, if I had a friend who pointed out that Lincoln, you know, didn't particularly care for ending slavery as long as he preserved the Union, something he said constantly and repeatedly, and he was called a liar. You know, so there's a lot of what they do is not unique to them. It's part of the human condition, and it really is kind of eye-opening. And the whole thing, every politician everywhere probably will say, I'm fighting for you. And that's, you know, that's what they're saying over there too.
I have a question about the occasional, well, the rare family reunification days that they allow.
Oh God, aren't those great?
What's in it for them? Why do they allow this? I mean, you were talking about porosity before, the border patrol and then right. The plants and the the carnival.
There's this.
How do they control what you say?
You can't watch these videos without crying. So these families were separated as a result of the Korean War, and these people hadn't seen each other for literally decades, like 30 years, 40 years. They had no word from each other, and they kind of had this detente with the South, and they let families reunite in Panmunjom or places like that. And you see brothers who haven't seen each other in 30 years, or like a dad who saw his daughter when she was 6, and now she's got kids, and she's like 40, and you watch them hugging, and it's just the most wonderful thing, you know, on earth possible. And this was there's a couple things. A, they are desperately interested in reunification according to their propaganda. And B, it humanizes them. And C, South Korea is a big sponsor of them. It's a way for them to kind of get money for them. Like, look, we're giving, it's kind of this tit for tat kind of thing of de-escalating tensions. And they can easily point to this as, look, reunification is coming. It's the wicked Americans who are keeping it separated. So I encourage anyone to go on YouTube and just look for the Korean reunification, and it'll just blow your mind. It's just wonderful.
But I'm wondering if each pairing is not monitored by a minder.
Oh, they are monitored. Those people are all carefully chosen.
Okay.
They had someone there with them. This was not, they're not going on a trip to Hawaii. Okay. I don't think they had further contact either. It's like, oh, great, you had your moment. Mm. Come with us.
Okay, so it's just a quick hug.
I don't think it was quick. I think they had a day, but the conversation is permitted, but someone's standing right here.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. But you know what? Honestly, if you don't see your family for 40 years, you don't need to say things that are indiscreet. You have lots to catch up on that are I'm sure completely politically acceptable to the North, and as long as you say everything's great.
Why would North Korea be excited and push reunification unless they believe that they're going to remain in power of the entire peninsula?
Well, that's exactly why. Kim Il-sung's 10-point plan, he had a 4-point plan, was basically his version of confederalism. And you have this half has their own system, this half has their own system, and then you've got the president. Gee, I wonder who that's going to be. It was the Clausewitz who said, politics is just war by other means. So this was just their attempt to kind of, and they really do have this obsession with Korea, the unified nation. So they want it for, genuine reasons, and you can't really blame them. And they look at, one of the things I have him talk about in the book, which they talk about, is people think reunification is never going to happen. He points out, he goes, look at Germany. Look at what happened in Ireland with the peace accord. He goes, it's never too late. And as he says, if you're saying the word impossible, you're not speaking Korean.
To follow up on that, though, I mean, the German example is surely apposite. The East Germany collapsed and became part of the Western capitalist state. So do they really believe that that's a model? I mean, clearly not.
They believe that it's a model in the sense that Korea was united for far longer than Germany was. Germany only became a nation in the 1800s, so it's not at all implausible. Yeah, it's going to be hard, but that we'd be back together. And they resent enormously. The reason they point to Germany is that as a consequence of World War II, only two nations were divided, Germany and Korea. And Korea wasn't an antagonist, so why are we the ones being separated? And Germany, who really did bad things, are all unified and kind of leading Europe.
I guess I was curious about the Copernicus-Columbus reference. Is that specifically geared towards Americans, or do they expect North Koreans to know it? And why don't they use Korean figures? Is it because that history is just... There is no Korea outside of Kim Jong-un and Kim
Jong-un. Is a great question, because I spoke to some refugees and they don't teach them geography. So the nations they're aware of are Korea, China, Russia, Japan, the U.S. That might be the list. So they didn't know about Hiroshima or Nagasaki. They don't teach them that. Maybe they teach them to hate Israel, because Israel, the U.S., and Japan are the axis of evil, according to them. So those examples, that's a very, very good question. They would not be teaching them about Copernicus or Columbus in school. But what's funny is, Kim Il-sung supposedly could teleport. One of the ways he defeated the wicked Jap bastards was using land-shrinking magic. So I spoke to a refugee, I go, was he literally teleporting, or was this like a metaphor for you can never know where he's coming next? And she goes, no, literally. And I'm like, did they talk about how he learned to teleport? And they're like, no, he can do it. You know? And she's like, I honestly believe that if he wrote his name on a piece of paper, the name could fly away. And I'm like, is that a function of the ink? Is the paper staying? But those stories are not translated. So she said they know that the really wacky stuff to keep internal. So they play, and also, like, I read a lot of books, and there'll be a reference to some particularly crazy North Korean story, and then I follow the footnote to their archives, and that story's been pulled. So they liked my book cover on Instagram. They play the West very, very well. If you convince Florence King, the former National Review writer, once said she can't wait to be looked at as the crazy old lady, because once you're crazy old lady, you're allowed anything. You know, no one's going to be like, what's she doing? Well, she's a crazy old lady. So if you convince everyone on Earth that you're completely crazy and can press that nuclear button at any moment, you really are in their heads and have a big sense of power over them, because they're going to be... Who isn't scared of a crazy person? I'm scared of crazy people.
Jim?
Did you get any insight into what China thinks about all this?
Yes. So China is basically North Korea's last ally, and they have had it. But North Korea is a very Soviet nation in many ways, and just like my people, they love, they kind of get off on being defiant. So all of you who are like signing Facebook petitions to tell Putin to stop gay, you know, to be for gay rights, that's really gonna get you a lot of traction in Russia in the other direction. And so when China's like, guys, let's rein it in, they're like, no, what are you gonna do about it? And in fact, the reason the eldest son wasn't chosen as a successor is he said, we need to be more like Beijing, we need to be more like the West. Kim Jong-il saw for himself the economic miracle that happened in China, and Kim Jong-il said, absolutely not, we're not Chinese. We are sticking through the Korean Juche idea through thick and thin, and if you want openness, open a window.
The big bad USSR collapsed without firing a shot. Sure. Economics and so forth. And that was a more, if I can use the term, civilized country, you might say, than North Korea. You have a fix on their military might. I mean, I know they have rockets and stuff. And
well, they have the fourth biggest army on Earth.
Yeah, that's fine, but you can obliterate them with a bomb. The question is the technology, the nuclear and stuff. Do you give much credibility to their nuclear?
They 100% have nukes. There's no question that they have nukes. The question is delivery, and would they fire them? I do not believe that they would fire them for Seoul. I have no doubt that they would aim for Tokyo. If they could reach the U.S., they would aim for the U.S. too. But again, for a nation that's been suicidal and crazy, they've outlasted everybody else. So it's really, so either they're really bad at being suicidal, or they're really good at something else. And my vote is for the second one. And again, part of what I tried to do with this book is to get people to have understanding of, you know, they're not these crazy suicidal people. They have a coherent philosophy that doesn't work for them, but certainly maintains the regime in power, despite, you know, the rest of the world being utterly against them.
One more question.
Yes.
How does ego and hubris relate to North Korea?
I also want to ask this, because in Ego and Hubris, they talk about you, it's a graphic comic book, talks about you're always being right about everything. And I'm reading this and thinking, did you really identify with your subject here? Because he's always right. You
know? I'm here and he's dead. So clearly one of us was always right and the other one wasn't. No, if you're so for those who don't know, Harvey Pekar of American Splendor fame wrote a graphic novel about my life entitled Ego and Hubris, which ends on an Ayn Rand quote. And it's the story, people ask me to sum it up in one sentence, and there's a couple of answers. It's A, the little engine that could but shouldn't. Or it's about a young boy who thought he was better than everybody else and was. And that one I really do believe. Because the book, but it's the... But I still got my wings. The reason why it's the opposite of Kim Jong-il is the book, which every laissez-faire books, you know, referred to me as the hero of my own life. It's a series of me going against authority figures, teachers, principals, bosses, you know, who are all, you know, reprehensible, awful people, and taking them down on their own terms. And this was not easy to do. And I take great pride in having the courage of my convictions when I did. Reading The Fountainhead certainly had a lot to do with that. I didn't blow up a building, but you know, if it happened, I wouldn't be too sad about it, having worked at Goldman Sachs. But I never tried to force my views on other people. If you want to have different perspectives, that's fine. Go live your life. It's a very big world. This isn't North Korea. Go live anywhere you want. Just don't come to my house.
Well, dear writer, thank you very much for your insights. Thank everyone for coming. For Reset Magazine, this is John Turner at the Museum of Sex.